Development for Wednesday. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 716. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 716 is a bill introduced by the Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs at the request of the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, and it would require designation of 1 in 8 disabled parking spaces for wheelchair users only. It would not apply to parking lots with fewer than 100 total spaces. It would require the spaces to have a sign that indicates wheelchair use only. The bill only requires that the spaces be designated and so marked when a parking lot is constructed or repainted, so it wouldn't take effect until it was a new parking lot or the parking lot was repainted. The original bill required a new placard and the -2 amendment, a new placard that you'd qualify for by rules by the Department of Transportation, so it would look different than the existing disabled parking placard. But the -2 amendments remove the new disabled wheelchair-only placard that you would hang in your vehicle and just require that the person be using a wheelchair to park in that spot. It does not require any additional parking spots or any additional width to the existing parking spots, but it redesignates some of the van-only parking spots, which are wider and have an aisle, which are as wheelchair-only. Mr. Chair, the fines that apply for illegally parking in the wheelchair spot would be the same fines that apply to unlawful parking in those spaces today. And one thing I wanted to point out in the bill is it looks like the table being removed is on page 1 of the bill, and it looks like, if you're just looking at that table, it looks like none of them are required to be van accessible. But if you look at page 2, line 24, the existing language is where the van accessible requirement comes in. So I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Montes Anderson, you want to start us off?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President.
I'll take that.
I'm still on form.
Let Peter know.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm happy to be here to talk about Senate Bill 716. Kevin O'Reilly came to me with this concept, and this is something he's been working on for a number of years, and I was more than happy to accommodate him because I had run into a similar situation when I'm driving my father around. And he was only able to be transported by wheelchair. And we would get to a place where there are handicapped parking, but they were full, and then there wasn't enough room to be able to have the door wide open and the wheelchair there, and then getting my father out of, and now this is for a van, but out of the vehicle and into the wheelchair. What this bill does basically is when there are 5 or more parking spaces that are designated handicap, that any space, one of them has to be reserved for wheelchair users, and it needs to be signage there needs to say wheelchair user. The van accessible parking spaces has a wider access aisle, and I think that we have the people on either side of me that maybe even have some pictures to show you regarding what is necessary. But I'd like them to tell their stories, and I would hope that we would be able to move this bill as soon as possible. I did notice a couple of errors, but I think that will be talked about when I'm up there. I'd like to turn
thank you. Thank you, Senator. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm here today representing the members of the Oregon Chapter of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. With me today is Daryl Ackerman. Daryl has had many years experience dealing with access issues, and as a matter of fact, he's helped written some of the code language that we currently have in Oregon. Senator Moniz Anderson was kind enough to introduce Senate Bill 716 on our behalf, and as she's already mentioned, Senate Bill 716 will reserve an accessible parking space for those who use wheelchairs or scooters when there are more than 100 parking spaces serving a facility. First, a little bit of background on all of this. Accessible parking has been around since 1973. Originally, those entitled to use the accessible parking spaces had to have a significant mobility impairment. When the law was written, this was defined as difficulty negotiating a 6-inch curb. Later, my understanding anyway, is that later this was amended to include those who had difficulty ambulating 200 feet or more. One of the questions is, why do we need accessible parking? Accessible parking is about equality. Not only does the playing field have to be accessible to persons with disabilities, but also the route to the playing field has to be accessible. And accessible parking is part of that route. And what accessible parking really provides is enough, a sufficient room for someone who uses a wheelchair to enter or exit their vehicle. Back in 73, they determined that 4% of the population used wheelchairs. So 4% of the parking should be accessible to those individuals. And they started out with 4 spaces in 100 that needed to be accessible, 1 in 25. Because the number of spaces increased, they reduced that number. They tried to load them up front so those parking spaces would be available under any situation that would arise. The disabled community requested that there always be one accessible space for people that have disabilities with an access aisle. And they designed two types of access aisles, were designed, two types of parking spaces. The first, the standard accessible parking space, has a 6-foot access aisle. The second type is the van accessible parking space with the 8-foot access aisle. The larger access aisle is designed to accommodate vehicles with lifts or ramps. And they also require that 1 in 8 of all accessible parking spaces be van accessible. Both types are designed to allow the wheelchair user sufficient room to enter and exit their vehicle. Since 1973, the legislature has broadened the criteria, and as such, the overall number of those eligible to obtain parking placards has increased significantly. There has not, however, been an increase in the number of accessible parking spaces. Now we have a problem of supply and demand. Those individuals who use wheelchairs are finding it increasingly difficult to find adequate, usable parking. The purpose of this bill is to create a compromise which would reestablish the original intent of having accessible parking, which is to allow those with significant mobility impairments sufficient room to enter and exit their vehicles. At the same time, we want to preserve the privileges for those with other medical issues and, of course, not impose any further restrictions on businesses. Many of those who can now use accessible parking are able to ambulate and do not need the access aisle. It's convenient to have it there, but there's no need. What they do require is parking close to a building's entrance. And again, we don't want to impose upon that need. What we propose is to reserve the van accessible space for wheelchair users after more than 100 parking spaces serving an affected facility. This would be the 5th required accessible parking space and would make one wheelchair user only parking space in every 8 of the accessible parking spaces. What this means is that between 100 and 400 parking spaces, only one will be reserved for the wheelchair user only. So again, we're not putting that much of an imposition on anyone, or at least we don't feel we are. Between 400 and 500 parking spaces, this would increase to 2 reserved spaces, and then 1/8 of 2% after 500 or over 500 parking spaces. So look at it another way. If there's 1,000 parking spaces, you'd be required to have 20 accessible spaces, 3 of which would be reserved for wheelchair users. 3 in 1,000. Again, it's not that big of an imposition, we don't feel, on anyone. ODOT has offered 2 amendments. The first would bring the renewal process in line with current state policy, and of course we would support this. We originally requested that the Oregon Department of Transportation develop a placard or decal would differentiate between a wheelchair user and a non-wheelchair user of the accessible parking spaces. In their second amendment, ODOT has determined that the cost would be approximately $120,000, and they propose an amendment to withdraw the criteria for that different placard. Because of the budget constraints the department is facing, we will support this amendment. And what we do request that the state anticipate this cost in the budget department's budget for the 2010 to 2012 budget cycle. Somebody brought up another option the other day, and that was, as you all may have heard, the feds are thinking of mandating that some form of U.S. citizenship be designated on everybody's driver's license. If that occurs, and it kind of looks like it will, we would ask that the state look at developing the differentiation in placards at that time. We do have one concern, and that is that ODOT develop a color scheme for the signs between wheelchair user only and a standard accessible space. And we could either write an amendment to this bill for that, or we could just let ODOT deal with it. ODOT has their division or section that deals with signage, and they have the knowledge and the experience to devise something without outside input, so to speak. And at this point, I'll let Daryl speak, and then if you have any questions, okay, we're more than happy to do our best to answer.
Thank you very much. Daryl, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Daryl Ackerman. I live in Eugene currently. As Kevin said, I got involved with the accessibility issues in the 1973 legislative session when I was a member of the Oregon Architectural Barriers Council at that time, and I happened to live in Salem. So myself and a gentleman named Chris Cassidy were kind of the primary legislative contacts at that time. And the rationale at that time for all of the accessible spaces was to basically, as Kevin said, to provide sufficient space for a wheelchair user to get in and out of the vehicle. Over time, and as the legislature has modified the requirements for the placards, we find that the majority of the disabled individuals currently using placards don't have the need of that extra space to get in and out of a car. They can get adequately in and out of their vehicle in a standard parking space. So I definitely support this particular legislation because it really doesn't have an impact, but it's going to provide that needed space for a limited number. I would like to see it go further and be all of the designated spaces and have a separate category for persons, for the disabled, who don't require that additional space. But that would increase the number, so we're not there yet. I've also been involved with the Oregon Disabilities Commission until it was basically wiped out in 04. I was a member of their access committee and dealt with the legislation all the way up through the development of the parking standards and ODOT standards, just been involved in working with that. I had debated as to whether I should even mention the new standards, but whether you're aware or not, the Oregon or the U.S. Department of Justice has adopted specific standards as part of the Americans with Disabilities Act dealing with parking. They utilize the ATBCB, Architectural Transportation Barriers Compliance Board, to develop standards for accessibility. That organization has combined two different sets of standards into one standard now, the ADA-ABA standards. Those were passed in 04. They have not yet been adopted by the Department of Justice, so they're not enforceable under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but they will be making some changes in the parking requirements. They're going to shift the number of van accessible spaces, which is currently 1 in 8, to 1 in 6. It'll be increasing the number of required van accessible spaces. It also modifies the width requirements of van accessible spaces. Width requirement is currently 8 feet. They're going to 132 inches on the new van accessible spaces. That new code will also be altering the requirement for the access aisle. It'll be changing the access aisle to a 6-foot access aisle on all vehicle spaces. Well, if you look at the total space, the 132 inches plus 6 feet, we're still talking about roughly 16 or 17 feet, which we currently have. Federals have 16 feet, Oregon has 17 feet for the overall space, van space, and access aisle. When I've contacted the Department of Justice relative to the to their acceptance of that new standard, it's become a joke. They say it's probably due in the spring, but that was in 04, and it's still due in the spring, but they haven't approved anything yet. But that is the trend or the direction that, that parking is going, and they've added some clarifications with respect to the accessible route from that vehicle space they've clarified the fact that that access aisle cannot overlap or overlay any vehicle route. So they've tried to clear up some of that language. Until it's adopted, we can't. But Oregon has always been visionary, and that's why we have our own section of code. We've modified the minimum standards of the ADA to make minimum standards for the state of Oregon. And I would encourage you folks to always look forward to going a little beyond the absolute minimum standard on things. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Ackerman. I'll see if the committee has some questions for either Mr. O'Reilly or Mr. Ackerman at the moment. Questions? I have a couple. I think, Mr. Ackerman, I think I'll ask you, because of your long history with this. We've had a number of issues regarding the disabled parking program, and I won't go into all of them now. I visit with Mr. O'Reilly about some we'll talk about, but going back to, for me anyway, 01 session when Senator Gary George was chairing the Transportation Committee, I was a member of that, and we had a lot of different issues. And I think you brought up a very good point in your testimony, and that is, you know, in terms of the history of the program, this is about, and why it's so important, it's about access. It's about making
correct.
Sure you have access, and appropriate access, for disabled. I just would like to hear your perspective after being involved in some 30 years. And I know you've heard myriad, you know, issues involved with the program. How do you feel, in terms of the modifications in the law and all this, are we adequately serving the real, you know, disabled in terms of access, you know, the wheelchair, the people that really have difficulty getting to and from places? Because there's just a lot of discussion about, you know, I use the word, you know, maybe abusing some parking spaces for some folks, and so that the people who really need them can't get them either. I just was curious from your own perspective how well the program is working. And I mean, obviously this amendment that you would like to the law is one aspect that suggests we're not getting to some of the real people's needs in terms of their accessibility here.
Well, that's a good one. Because I've been an old timer in a wheelchair, I do remember the days when you couldn't find a parking spot anywhere that you could get out of your vehicle in. I don't use a van lift. I get out of a car. In fact, you'll see me climbing into my car in the photograph in the packet. I think you handed those out, Kevin.
Yeah, it would be the second page of the photograph.
So I get in and out of the car. I don't use a van lift. But I need a car, like a two-door, that's got a big door. And you just can't open it all the way up in a standard parking space. And you've all experienced that. I'm sure you've all been scrunched in, even with a regular car. So, yes, in that sense, it's working, in the sense that we have places to park today. But now to put it into a different perspective, if we're looking at it today, if I were recently disabled, I would say it's probably not working too well. Because I can go to Jerry's Building Materials. It's got 2, 4, 6, 8 accessible parking spaces, and I can rarely find one open, and I never see anybody getting out with a wheelchair. That I've been there. And I'll clarify that, because I did see once a guy getting back into his car with a wheelchair, so he'd obviously gotten out at some point. But most of the disabled community now that have placards are ambulatory and don't require that additional space. And it would really be a service to those individuals who use power chairs specifically that have a lift situation that need that 8 feet. I'd certainly be for making all of those van accessible spaces only wheelchair spaces. That'd be a problem for me in a way, because in some cases there's only one space required, and that would be van accessible if you have a 25 or less parking spaces. And I wouldn't be able to park there. I'd have to go find some other place. But that's a different kind of a ball game. But the state's made a pretty good effort at trying to comply with it. Historically, yes, it's made a big difference. But if you're disabled today, you're noticing the hardships. Illegal use of parking placards, which was another aspect of your question. I've had 3 of my parking placards stolen out of my vehicle when I was valet parking in Portland. I no longer leave my placard in a car. I carry it with me in my bag to alleviate that problem, because there's a black market for parking placards. And yes, parking placards are keyed to your driver's license. So if a patrol officer were to check the parking placard and look at my driver's license, they would see that I indeed qualify for a placard. But by far, the majority of the time, an officer looking at a parked vehicle is not going to be able to match that placard with an individual's driver's license, unless the officer wants to stand there till a person comes back. It's just not practical. So that makes the market for the placard. You hang the placard in the window, and chances are nobody's around to check on it. So that's a problem. I don't know how we're going to address that one.
Yeah.
That's going to be a tough one on the black market that way.
Well, we had a real good program, and I remember the testimony from the volunteers. We each had the volunteer enforcement group.
Yes.
And, you know, that's kind of gone by the wayside. And either of you, I'd be interested in your comments about, in terms of it, how you think enforcement is going to protect the spaces for those who need them, and if that is actually working well or not.
Those, Senator Metzger, members of the committee, those communities that still have volunteer parking enforcement programs, Multnomah County, Washington County, Milwaukee has one, or they're still implementing one, are doing very good. They don't have enough volunteers, of course, but they're going out there and they are finding placards being misused, whether I'm using my mother's placard or whether it's a stolen placard or an expired placard. They are finding them, and they are stopping that sort of abuse. I think it's probably a bigger issue in the bigger cities. Portland, I can see where it would be. Parking is expensive in Portland, and if you had a placard, you could save yourself quite a bit of money every year. I think it's probably less of an issue in the rural communities, where there's just not the same population pressures as you'll have. I think if we could find some way, some other incentive to have communities put together volunteer parking enforcement programs, they would, and they would benefit from those. Mm-hmm. Overall, I know a couple years back in Portland, they pulled in over 700, maybe it was seven, might have been $70,000 in fines. Mm-hmm. Just volunteer parking enforcement program.
Yeah. So. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Evans from the department, if you could come forward.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, here to talk to Senate Bill 716. Currently, there are a number of different parking placards that ODOT issues, temporary, permanent, family, program. Each requires that a certificate be received from the physician. They're free. None of them right now, as you know, are for wheelchair-only parking places or wheelchair-only users. There's currently 175,000 placards in issuance, and about 65,000 to 75,000 are issued every year. This bill, in its original form, requires that disabled parking placards be produced and issued by DMV for wheelchair users only, and that a certain number of disabled parking spaces be reserved exclusively for wheelchair use. Based on estimates from the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, we're looking at probably 26,000 users that are wheelchair users in Oregon that would be eligible for this program. Each would have to go back to their physician and get recertified under the new program, and we anticipate that the majority of them would indeed do that. It would be necessary for DMV to create a temporary position to handle this workload for the first biennium and to do some rather extensive programming to the computer system. We've been working with Senator Montes Anderson and Kevin O'Reilly on this bill for some time now, and in looking at the analysis that came through, we discovered that it was about $122,000 startup costs for this program. So went back and have recommended an alternative that would cut those costs, would actually remove those costs, and that would be to do away with the placard part of this and just have the requirement for the wheelchair-only parking spaces. That's indeed a compromise. It would compromise the enforcement and diminish the enforcement, but at least it gets us part of the way there without the expense. So we're offering that as an amendment, the -2 amendments. We also, Mr. O'Reilly also talked about the design of a sign. We have a, ODOT has an advisory committee. It's the Oregon Transportation Control Device Advisory Committee that comprises representatives from cities and counties and law enforcement. They take a look at these different types of signs and produce the standards that are then used by the various parking lots and folks that have the parking spaces. And looking forward to working with Mr. O'Reilly in designing that sign, or at least those standards. So with that, I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Go ahead, Senator Starr.
Thank you. How long is one of these placards good for?
The current placards are good for, if you're talking about a regular permanent placard, it's 8 years. It's a period of 8 years. You can also get a temporary placard if you, let's say, you've broken your leg, and that's good for 30 days. There's also a placard that's available if a disabled person wants to rent a car, and that's good for also for 30 days maximum.
So if another way to potentially address the issues for the department is just make this for prospective either reapplications after the expiration date of an existing placard, or somebody that comes in to get a new one, they don't have one now, but it comes in to get a new one, you could create a wheelchair only. Couldn't the department do that and not have any additional cost to the department whatsoever?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, in order to create the program with a separate placard, you would have to do the rather extensive programming. And it involves two systems. There's the one system that is the inventory system for anything that's issued, whether it costs anything or not. And then that keys into a secondary system that allows law enforcement and DMV to look up the placards and tie them to the driver's license or whatever. So I'm told that that's a fairly extensive process, hence it's rather costly in terms of programming time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime we create that placard, we'd have to do that type of a program.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. How much would that cost?
The programming component's is estimated to be about $65,000.
That's way too much. You got to be kidding me.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, no. This is a system that is it's evolved from the 60s. It touches all the money and inventory that DMV deals with. So anytime you make a change to that system, you have a huge amount of programming involved and a large amount of testing that's involved, too.
Well, I would suggest that $65,000 to do some programming is ridiculous, and the department ought to go back and crunch the numbers and come back with a reasonable figure. And I would like to see this this amended so that it is prospective, so that when folks come in to reapply or re-up their placard, that going forward they would have the ability to get a wheelchair-only one, or if it's a new applicant, somebody new comes into the system, wants a wheelchair-only placard, that we can do that. The department then would have the opportunity to phase this in over some time. And, $65,000 is way too much money. I don't believe the number. And even if it is $65,000 in an agency that's got several billion dollars, it shouldn't be a big problem for the department to handle.
Thank you, sir. That's a question I was going to ask Mr. Evans. since there is no charge to the applicant for the card,
correct,
it's paid for elsewhere. So where do the funds come from to pay for this program?
Senator Metzger, the funds come out of the highway fund.
So these are so this program is eligible for highway funds?
Senator Metzger, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, that gives us one clue. Senator Decker, you have a question?
More for you, Mr. Chair. So we would just keep the creation of parking spaces, and then if we were doing Senator Starr's idea, which sounded good to me, so you would keep the creation and then just do the perspective on the placards?
Well, that would certainly be one way, yeah. Or we could do the original bill and create a, you know, a separate and distinct, you know, placard and have people apply for that. I mean, a number of ways you could go with that. You know, my own feeling is on it, since we're trying to achieve something here, is that if we're going to make a distinction for those who need the wheelchairs, I think it would be good. My own personal view is to be able to readily identify that. I think there's also a public pressure that if someone pulls into a wheelchair only when it isn't, and we can't, you know, the average Joe who walks by can't see the difference, or if they can know the difference, I think that helps encourage those spaces to be used by the people who really need them. We're going to chew on this a little bit. There's a couple other issues I'm talking to some of the advocates about, and then we'll bring the bill back, because obviously we're going to have one kind of amendment or not on it. And
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ronna Sanderson.
Yeah. I actually do not have a problem with the Dash 2s. It's going to take a tremendous amount of work for the various industries or companies to get the signs and get the parking spaces painted and getting the signs. I think that it would be nice to be able to move forward with the Dash 2s and get that started. But there are some other changes, and I take into account those of us who transport our passengers who are disabled. We need to, the wording needs to be, the way the amendment is, it sounds like only those who are driving, and we need to make sure that it covers the passenger who is the wheelchair user rather than the driver, and that wasn't designated in the amendment. But someone who has taken someone who is in a wheelchair, we really need that extra space, and I would like to get that process started. I went to this huge retirement community with my father and could not find a parking spot close by, so I took him out of the car right at the front door and just left him in the wheelchair. I said, Dad, I'll be just hang tight. I had to park almost a block and a half away, and the people there in the building thought that I had dropped off my father and was abuse, and they were all concerned. There were all these people around him, so access is really an issue, and so I want to make sure that we proceed with not let the cost of this. I agree that with time I think we can get to where the committee wants to go, but I truly want to move forward on at least getting the signage and the spots set up.
Okay, well, thank you, Senator Morris Anderson. The Dash 2s also have the deletion of the wheelchair-only card, and I think I don't want to move on that at this point. I think there's some interest in the committee to help make that distinction. We'll figure out what's the best way to go on doing that, and we'll bring it back soon, hopefully with that suggestion, because I feel strongly about the fact that well, first of all, people who really need them should be using them, number one. And number two, the people who really need them, when that space should be there for them. You know, that's why we're creating it, and I don't want other people in those spaces. And to the extent that we can make sure that people who really have mobility problems, and that there's going to be a space for them in all likelihood. And so I kind of like the way the original bill, at least the content of it, and we'll talk to the department and see what way we might go on that. So we'll bring the bill back, but right now we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 716. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2079, the Board of Accountancy. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2079 at the request of the Oregon Board of Accountancy, clarifies current statutes relating to license requirements for public accounts, licensed chartered accountants, and applicants for substantial equivalency with substantial equivalency provisions. The board is allowed under the bill to establish by administrative rule the requirements for public accountancy experience for a person that's taking the licensing exam, and it removes some obsolete language. There is a Carol Reeves from the department is here to explain the bill, and there is a dash one amendment that we received just before the meeting, and I'll be passing that out too. This is not this was requested by Ted Hughes, and he's also on the sign up.
Okay, well, let's ask Carol and Ted to both come up. It's only two have signed up, so. Welcome.
Shall I go first?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much. My name is Carol Reeves. I'm the administrator for the Board of Accountancy. And the board very much appreciates this opportunity to talk about House Bill 2079 with you. This bill is proposed to amend various provisions that relate to different licensing requirements that are within the board's regulatory authority. The board's intent is to eliminate ambiguities that currently exist in the statute. I will address these revisions with the chair's permission in the order that they're noted on the document that you're receiving, and give a moment's pause as I move from one subject to the other if you should have questions that you'd like to bring to my attention at that time.
Okay.
The very first section discusses something that is called substantial equivalency, and the public accounting profession overall has undergone significant changes in recent years, most notably changes that result from increased demands to provide client services across state lines. Our economy is no longer limited by the parameters of the state in which you live. Over the last 10 years, state boards have collaborated to develop a scheme that would facilitate interstate practice by licensed, certified public accountants. This is the standard that's known as substantial equivalency. And the provisions are embodied in the Uniform Accountancy Act, which is a model act, and of which states adopt provisions as they see fit within their regulatory scheme. The Oregon Board approved provisions for substantial equivalency in 1999. The revisions in House Bill 2079 are now necessary because significant changes have been made to the Uniform Act, and we made the mistake of tying our program to the Uniform Act. Since the Uniform Act is by its nature evergreen, that means that our statute changes as the Uniform Act changes. The board would like to make sure that the provisions for licensed certified public accountants from another state meet the requirements that we have under substantial equivalency in Oregon. Specifically, the change that the board did not like initially, when it was adopted in 1999, actually, the board adopted it in 1999, but in 2002, the Uniform Act was changed to provide a 5-year grace period for any certified public accountants who didn't meet substantial equivalency standards, and the board is willing to accept that. Since that time, the grace period has been extended an additional 5 years to 2012. This principally abrogates the whole proposal of substantial equivalency, that you know the standards of competency that a licensee has before you allow him or her to practice in your state under this provision. And so the board does not want to be tied to these changes as they continue to grow. And so the section in our statute in this bill just brings it back into our licensing requirements. The board also approved or adopted provisions that would allow reciprocity for chartered accountants who are licensed by designated foreign countries. Chartered accountant is the name that is used for the comparable certified public accountant in many foreign countries. You're probably most familiar with it from its usage in Canada. They are chartered accountants. eligibility for reciprocity in the state of Oregon for chartered accountants in other foreign jurisdictions is based on evaluation of the licensing requirements of the foreign jurisdiction itself rather than of the individual person. And the provisions allow that people who are licensed under this foreign jurisdiction that has been evaluated and that has been approved by the state may apply for reciprocity in Oregon. This has not been clearly stated. The word recognized was earlier in the sentence and made it seem as though it was the individual who was recognized, but it is, in fact, the jurisdiction. So this is merely a clarification. The third section has to do with applicants for license as a public accountant. The board licenses two levels of licensed accountants in Oregon, the certified public accountant and the public accountant. And the eligibility standards to obtain either of these licenses differs from one to the other. The purpose of the change here is just to clarify that a public accountant must meet the same experience requirements and standards as do certified public accountants. The language includes the words satisfactory to the board, and we have inserted the words based on administrative rules set by the board. Finally, a very simple change. In 2004, the Uniform Certified Public Accountant Exam, which is accepted by all 54 jurisdictions, took a wild leap and became computerized. And at that time, the requirements for the way you took the exam, requirements for maintaining credit for sections of exam that you passed, were changed dramatically. One of the provisions under the prior exam, when it was a paper and pencil exam, required that you must pass two sections of the exam before you could transfer credits from another state. This is no longer a requirement, and it's no longer necessary. When we changed our rules and our statute to accommodate the computer exam, it was overlooked, and at this time it should be removed. That's all I have.
Well, Janet has a question, then I have a question. You don't have a question. My question would be, first of all, your reaction to the dash one that Mr. Hughes is going to talk about in a moment.
The dash one simply puts the statute back the way it was before. We have, in the last 12 years, six people have been licensed as a public accountant. It's a very small number of people who wish to apply and achieve that license. The dash one amendment would not make a significant difference for the board. If Mr. Hughes and his group are intent upon that, I believe that the board could accept it.
All right. Well, now we'll ask Mr. Hughes why he wants it. Mr. Hughes, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes, representing the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. That's a group of tax consultants, tax preparers, enrolled agents, public accountants, and a smattering of CPAs. When this bill was in the House, I want to apologize. We should have surfaced with this amendment in the House side. I interpreted everything was fine, and I just found out recently after my legislative committee met that they would rather have this amendment that I proposed, dash one, on page 5, line 21, out of the bill, and they, unbeknownst to me, they had met with Senator Carter in Portland, and Margaret agreed with them and told that group that she was going to ask for this amendment to be prepared for your committee. And I talked to John yesterday, and John says, oh my gosh, she, you know, with the death of her sister, she's gone. She would have done it had she been here. So Senator Starr was kind enough to ask for this amendment in the Legislative Council. The reason it's a concern with them, of course, is being a public accountant is what they aspire to. It's a goal that tax consultants and tax preparers sometimes shoot for. It doesn't sound like very many of them does with Carol's testimony that only six in the last year and a half, but they want it defined in the statute so they know exactly if they want to move up from a tax preparer or a tax consultant to a public accountant, they'll know exactly which route to go. And that was their reason. That was their they didn't want to give that rulemaking authority to change the rules to the Board of Accounts. It's not that they have anything complaints about the Board of Accounts and how they operate. They're a very professional organization. It's just that they want certainty, and they'd rather have certainty in law than the ability to administrative rules being changed on them. That was the reason, sir.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Janet had a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to ask Carol, how are the equivalent the experience satisfactory to the board? How is that determined now on a case-by-case basis, or is...
No, there are administrative rules, and the administrative rules that all experience must be supervised by a licensed certified public accountant or public accountant who has in fact held that license in active status for 5 years prior to the supervision and all during the period of supervision. The board believes that whether you are going to be licensed as a public accountant or as a certified public accountant, your experience should have the same type of supervision to assure your competency in your education.
Thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like a response from both of you on this. When I read this bill, it always makes me nervous when we're trying to get along with other states and other jurisdictions. We have the Uniform Accountancy Act, which is basically generally agreed to. And in essence, when I read this bill, it makes me nervous because it seems like we're sort of bunkering down and saying, okay, we're going to create our own standards that are different than everybody else has. We're going to make it so that even if you meet everything in a foreign country, but it's not recognized by our board, we're not going to let you practice here. It seems to me that what we're doing is really tightening down the regulations. So, and my fear is that I kind of believe that people, if they have the experience to do it, and I'm willing to hire them to do it, if they have the experience to, they should be allowed to be certified, especially if they have the education. And I'm trying to figure out really the underlying reason for this piece of legislation at all. I'm really trying to see where the harm is in the way it's currently being done that seems to put us in cooperation with all the other states in the union on this and working ably with foreign countries. I know a number of my businesses do a lot of international business, and I need to be able to have accountants from all sides working on stuff, and I don't really feel like coming down and talking to the Board of Accountants to get permission. So I'm trying to kind of get a purpose for this and why this is a pressing need.
Senator Metzger? Senator George? I'll speak to the chartered accountant provision first. The various countries around the world may have programs to educate and license a chartered accountant. Those programs vary widely, and they may or may not rise to the same level of competency or education or experience that certified public accountants are required to obtain before being licensed. They may also differ from country to country. For example, chartered accountants in Canada may have more stringent education requirements than chartered accountants in Africa. But there are chartered accountants in many, many countries. And so the process that was devised was that the program itself from country to country would be evaluated to determine how close it was, how close the standards came to being equal or better than the standards for a certified public accountant. And then there would be an agreement between the country and an organization in the United States, the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, which is our professional organization. And by that memorandum or agreement, then states could rely on the evaluation that's been done of the standards in that country, that those standards are sufficiently similar to ours, that reciprocity would assure public protection through competency of the individuals. To this date, we have these agreements with Canada, with Mexico. In Australia, there are two levels of licensees who have been approved under these agreements, and also in Ireland. The Board of Accountancy has approved all of those in their rules for reciprocity. The organizations are currently working on the chartered accountants, or working with the chartered accountants in India to provide the same evaluation and credential for them. It's a matter of making sure that the name chartered accountant is the same, is equal everywhere. And as it is, it is not. The requirements are not the same from one country to another.
If I could follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the foreign part of it was just one small aspect of it. And really what I'm looking at is, I'm not really concerned, and excuse me, Mr. Hughes, but I'm not really concerned with the accountant profession. I'm more concerned with the businesses that use the accountant profession of accountants. And so when I read this, and just understand from casual reading, what it looks like is that we use the Uniform Accountancy Act, which is consistent around the country. We are trying to interact with other states, and what this looks like is that Oregon's going to kind of go its own way, and the board is going to be able to write rules and adopt criteria that may be different than what the other states are doing, and it seems to me like it's adding a layer of regulation from us being able to have some reciprocity with other states. Foreign countries is just one example that I picked out here from one of the sections. And I'm trying to understand what's wrong with the status quo. I mean, to me, I don't want to protect the industry of accountants in Oregon. I want to protect the businesses that are using that industry. And if they can get an accountant out of New York easily and use them, I'm having a hard time understanding why that's a bad thing. And it seems like to me this makes it more difficult for businesses to use out-of-state accountants. And I'm trying to understand why. What's the purpose of that?
Thank you, Senator George. Senator Metzger, if I may. The reason for the legislation is really looking toward the future. Because we had tied our substantial equivalency to the Uniform Act in the statute, that left the board open and vulnerable to any changes that may occur in the Uniform Act at any time in the future. At this point, the Oregon Board of Accountancy, our program will allow licensing under this program from virtually every state in the union, because if they don't meet the specific standards of substantial equivalency that are written in the Uniform Act, then we go further to our reciprocity provisions, which allows even a broader demonstration of your qualifications and your eligibility. Furthermore, someone who presents an application or wishes to practice in Oregon through substantial equivalency, and excuse me, may I say that the only people who are eligible for substantial equivalency are those who are located outside of our state, okay? Those applications are processed between 24 and 48 hours. They're issued. If we find that there was something missing, we'll come back then and require them to provide it. But they receive their permit or their authority to practice within 48 hours in Oregon. It's a very expedited process. It is not the board's intention to restrict this privilege to anyone. It is simply to protect us from changes that may occur in the Uniform Act as time goes on.
One last follow-up, if I could. Could you give me an example of one of these things that we're worried about happening in the potential in the future? It seems like to me that that the Uniform Accountancy Act, as I always understood it, because I was an accounting major in college and was considering going the CPA route and decided I didn't have the patience, but
you became a legislator.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting the patience.
I got my ADD kicked in, so I don't have the attention span. But it seems like to me that I'm trying to figure out what we're trying to avoid. This. It's a pretty sweeping piece of legislation, really, because we're completely shifting to the state coming up with its own set of standards, which means you guys are going to rewriting rules, and that's a pretty big step. And we're granting, from the way I read this, huge rule writing authority to the board on this front. And so I'm trying to figure out what we're trying to avoid. And if you give me an example of something that could happen, maybe it would give me some kind of comfort.
The example that I used earlier is that they've extended their grandfather period an additional 5 years out from the original five in the Uniform Act. And the board sees that as a potential for what could happen later on. I did not bring my entire statute with me. I apologize. But there's a section in our statute, 673.153, that speaks directly to the substantial equivalency requirements and lays them out in statute. This is what you must meet in order to do it. So it's not as though it's in rule, and it gives us the flexibility to change it as we wish. Rather, it is stated, and it states the exact requirements of the Uniform Accountancy Act. And those three requirements are known as the three E's, education, experience, and exam. They require that an individual have 150 hours of education, have 1 year of experience under proper supervision, and to have passed the uniform CPA exam. So that doesn't change. But what they've done is they've said for the first 5 years, you don't have to meet these requirements and you can still receive this privilege in all states. And now we come along later and say for the next 5 years, we're going to extend it again until 2012. And so it's that sort of broad changes that are made in the Uniform Act that the board does not necessarily feel provide adequate public protection under our law. Rather, we have defined our standards, and if one doesn't meet those standards, then we will look back to our reciprocity provisions. For example, if the individual has 2 years of experience, they'll qualify. If the individual has 4 years out of 10 practicing public accountancy, they will qualify. So it's a very flexible standard, and it doesn't deviate at all from the Uniform Act, except at this point, from not being willing to accept the 2012. And it wasn't so much that the 2012 was a problem, it was what else, you know, might occur. What else might change that the board would rather review and adopt without it automatically becoming part of the statute because we inadvertently used the Uniform Act in our statute when we first passed it.
Okay, Senator Morris, you had a question.
I have concerns with this bill also. I feel most boards are a little parochial, and I liken this to how it used to be with nurses and dentists, for that matter. You could be trained as a dentist and nurse in another state, yet you'd have to go through the whole rigmarole of getting your license and taking exams when you come into Oregon. And we have done away with that. So that, and to me, I just feel this is taking us backwards and protecting those accountants in the state, and making it more difficult for those who are trained outside of the state, from coming in. And we're just, I just see it as a little parochial.
I have no response. I feel as though I've explained that I don't feel it is all inflexible. I feel that we are more flexible than many states.
Primarily through your reciprocity procedures, right?
Yes, because we allow that. And in our turnaround period, many states have a period of time before the person is allowed to enter the state and begin practicing. The states by no means have implemented this in the same fashion from one state to another, which is one of the problems with state licensing.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I feel comfortable with it. We'll see if the committee does. I appreciate your explanation. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2079.
Move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2079.
Senator Starrs, move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2079. Discussion on the amendment. Any objection to the amendment? So ordered.
Move House Bill 2079 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll ask for the roll.
George?
No.
Senator Decker?
Oh, gosh.
Would you like to have some comments?
Can we reschedule it for April 15th? Have more of some accountants come in, or April 14th, and have some accountants can talk about it.
Accountants support.
Aye.
Senator Montes-Hanson?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
I have received constitutional authority to declare it passed, and I will carry the bill. Okay.
Minority report it. Do a minority report.
There you go. First 55-0 bill with the minority report.
Yeah, let's,
okay, I thought that was going to be an easy one.
Do a minority report to eliminate the foreign account.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let's open up public hearing on House Bill 2109. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2109 is considered a housekeeping bill, but so was the last bill. And
Mr. Smith sweat.
tries to clear up the construction contractor board statutes by dividing them into sections that make more sense and are internally consistent. One of the changes in the bill is the repeal of 701-100 and the restatement of the of provisions in section 14 of the bill at toward the end of the bill, and some of those provisions are not listed in 701-100, but they are consistent with how the statutes have been interpreted. Mr. Chair, Craig Smith is here from the department. This bill also had no trouble in the House, and the repealed section is listed is at your place as well as the rest of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please come forward.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. I'm passing out a document that I'll be working off of today. This is testimony on 2109-A. This is a bill that, as amended, passed the House 53-1. It's a bill that originally was simply a rewrite of a statute that had gotten voluminous over the years and kind of disjointed. We thought this was a very simple bill. And it still is, we think. One thing that it does, at the suggestion, frankly, of legislative counsel, is it took paragraph 10 in the current statute under 701.055 and made it parallel with respect to cities, counties, and other subdivisions. You'll find that change in the bill on page 2. On line 34, wherein it added the word after counties or political subdivisions. Don't believe this provides any policy change. It was our belief that it was merely something that had been left out by accident, and we thought that this was a good chance to correct that. The amendment came late in the in dealing with this bill, and policy change. What the amendment does, and you'll see that in the handout at the bottom of the page, wherein it talks about adding additional authority for the Construction Contractors Board to discipline the licensee. And during the summer, we had a situation where a plumber lost its license over at the Building Codes Division, and the Building Codes Division asked us, as a lot of times DCBS does and other agencies, asked us to take a similar action against our licensee, because if perhaps they're doing a bad job there, they should be disciplined with CCB. We took a long look at that, and after discussions with several groups, it was determined we didn't have authority, and that didn't make a lot of sense to us. So what this bill does is it makes it clear under 701.100, besides a raft of other state agencies, that clearly for the Plumbing Board and a few others, that the agency has authority to consider taking the Construction Contractors Board license against away from the business if it is out of compliance with other state laws. That's the amendment.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
Okay, the said plumber. In order to be licensed, he has dual licenses, one with DCBS, one with CCB.
Yes.
In order to be, the license that relates to DCBS primarily has to do with plumbing in large commercial facility or commercial or industrial. Is that correct?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, I wouldn't go that far. I think that plumbing business has to have a license that Building Codes Division is...
No matter what? So you have to have, if you're a plumber, you got to have a dual license no matter what kind of plumbing you do?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, I'm not a plumber, and I can't answer that question very accurately. I can tell you that any kind of a plumbing business that deals with the public gets a license with CCB because we handle the dispute resolution process, we handle the insurance, we handle the accountability in case they do something bad against their customer. That's what we do.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm still trying to get to the bottom of this. The you brought up the plumber. The plumber, in order to do residential plumbing on a new residential construction, does that plumber have to have a DCBS license?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, yes, it does.
Okay. So can the plumber who has his DCBS license continue to do any plumbing work whatsoever in the state of Oregon, regardless of what happens to the CCB license? Lawfully?
Right. Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, if the plumber loses his license with DCBS, it does not, it loses its authority to operate as a plumbing business. And so the answer to your question is yes, it doesn't have authority to do plumbing work.
So what does it matter that you can suspend his license or not?
Right. Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, I think the matter is that when a contractor is out of compliance with a variety of other regulations, including workers' comp, independent contractor law, various tax laws, and in this case we're talking about a trade law, and it remains out of compliance, CCB ought to have the authority to discipline that contractor. What this law is makes it very clear that if it loses its license at its trade license, that we have that authority to take a look at that contractor.
Just to follow up. Mm-hmm. The so in those other items you listed, tax and I don't know, I didn't write them down, don't remember them. Do you have the ability to punish that contractor in those areas? And so this is just adding DCBS to that list. Is that what I understand you to say?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, this the answer is this does add plumbers. It adds a few other things. On page 3 in the handout, there is a chart that goes over the rewrite of the disciplinary statute and talks about whether it's existing law or it's additional law. And in that chart, you'll see that one item has to do with being out of compliance with a lien law requirement, the Homeowners Protection Act. That is an additional disciplinary possibility. The next item has to do with Chapter 316 and 317. That is personal income tax. Manufactured homes. That is in Senate Bill 192. I'm not sure if this committee dealt with that issue. I believe it did. But this makes it clear that the Construction Contractors Board would be able to discipline a contractor if it was out of compliance with manufactured home law. Same thing with the installer's law. The next one is the plumbing regulations. The next one is the building codes law, but that's existing in the law currently. On page 2, item G is the elevators. Again, something that would make it parallel with Senate Bill 192. The next one, H, has to do with electrical code. The next one, item I, has to do with plumbers. Has to do with boilers. So we'll make it parallel with Senate Bill 192.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Smith, I guess I'm confused. I understand I can read the list, too. The question is this current law today that if these folks are out of compliance with these other regulations, whether it's homeowner protection, income tax, plumbing, building codes, elevators, whatever. If they're out of compliance today, does the CCB have the authority to suspend their CCB license today, or is this new that we're going to do in this bill understand that some of these are incorporated into Senate Bill 192, which I don't think has become law yet.
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, you'll notice again in the chart there are several items there at the bottom of the chart on page 2 where it indicates, for example, workers' comp, item J, that's existing law. Where it says existing law, it's existing.
Okay.
And so any item where it doesn't say existing law, it would be a new possible disciplinary procedure.
Okay. Thank you. I apologize for dragging this out. Thank you,
sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. I understand. Other questions for Mr. Smith? Okay. Thank you very much. I don't think we have anybody else set to testify on this bill. Is that correct?
Jessica's raising her hand, waving up and down, doing jumping jacks. Hoping to get our attention. Maybe
it's because I didn't have a list.
Mr. Kafouri?
Oh, Mr. Kafouri, yes, please.
He's the only one signed up.
Oh, yes, Ms. Stone's the only one signed up. See, right here. For the record, these people have shown up without invitation. They just decided to think about this bill after all this time. Ms. Jessica, would you like to come forward at the request of the committee?
Yes, I would be happy to do that.
And I'll get you to you next. Women first. Okay.
Mr. Chair, member.
No discrimination.
She has an epiphany here. So about this bill now. Welcome.
We think it's a fabulous piece of legislation. This is Jessica Adamson with the Associated General Contractors. The changes to House Bill 2109 from they occurred in the House Committee, we believe are appropriate. And the net effect is if someone has had so many problems with the Building Codes Division that they finally got their license revoked over there, which really takes some effort to get to that point, that at that point in time, your license should be suspended or revoked at the Construction Contractors Board. We feel that that's appropriate because, again, by the time you get to that point, you have been a bad actor for a while, and it's probably time for you to take a break and reassess your business model. And so we support this legislation as a step forward in really saying you need to, there needs to be some connectivity there. So, again, we feel that this bill is appropriate and would encourage your passage.
Well, thank you, Jessica. You know, I mean, unlike Senator Starr, you have had a lot more experience, you know, in the contracting world than I have. I thought it was interesting, and we've heard this with some of the other pieces of legislation we had, is about the dual certification licensing. Because, you know, in contracting, just being the layperson, you know, one of the things you think you're being smart about, you know, is, you know, getting their CCB number, you know. So, you know, someone, the bad actor you talked about, could still have a CCB number, you know. Yeah, here's my number. I'm, you know, I've never been suspended by the Construction Contractors Board, and just find out that, you know, there's all kinds of lawsuits pending in circuit court or something else because we didn't realize that there was another governing body. You know, no one goes around on their truck saying, you know, a DCBS number, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's all CCB. So, I mean, this was something I just learned last few years myself. So, I appreciate your comments on that. Mr. Kafouri, would you like to comment on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. Mr. Chair, I learned a long time ago that when you make a mistake like coming into a committee late, the first thing to do is to blame it on staff. So what I'll say is that the staff took the sign-up sheet away before I had a chance. Not my fault.
Well, someone else might turn that around. The efficiency of your staff.
The efficiency of your staff.
Precluded me from coming in late and testifying.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that the Oregon Remodeler Association has taken a look at the bill. Most of it, as you know, is just a review of and reorganization of what of existing law. Doesn't change anything. We do agree with the one change that it does have, and we're very supportive of anything that helps protect the consumer.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kafouri?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's close public hearing on House Bill 2109. We're going to work session on House Bill 2109.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2109 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? Ordered. We'll make the decker excuse.
I think it'll make you carry the bill.
And and we'll ask Senator Decker to carry the bill. Yeah. I think that is a great idea. Okay, Senator Decker will carry the bill, so that way we'll know the whole committee was up to speed on it. Let's open up the public hearing on House Bill 2111, Janet.
Chair, I just cannot figure out how to keep my space.
Well, I know that problem.
House Bill 2111, and you have at your place the House Staff Measure Summary, and this bill is at the request of the Construction Contractors Board as well. It requires contracting businesses, business owners that claim status as a responsible managing individual, exercise management and supervisory authority over the activities of the business. Currently, it is required that the additional language is on page line 6 of the bill, and I want to point out that the line 9 has the word and in it, so it requires that they do all of those things to be a responsible managing individual. Craig Smith is here again to explain the purpose for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith, welcome again.
Chair Metzger, member of the committee, again, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. This is a fairly simple bill. Again, it's one that has gone to the House. It was passed 59 to with one excused. As you know, we do test contractors, new contractors, for competency, business competency. It's a fairly simple test, but the person that has to take that test is the responsible managing individual. And in this case, what we've learned over the last few years is there's been a couple of situations where the person that takes the test isn't running the business. In fact, it appears as if the person who has taken the test is a professional who is marketing their fact that they've taken the test. And that's probably not a good thing. What this bill would do is correct that situation, and so we'd bring it before you for your thoughts.
Well, that's interesting. When I was in college, I would have loved to have one of those people. take the test for me. Are you starting to see more of that, Mr. Smith?
Yeah. Chair Metzger, I'm not sure if we're seeing more of it. We did run a couple of checks. We know that it's not uncommon for a person to have more than one business. That can happen. But in one case, there's one individual who appears to have 20 different businesses, many of which don't seem to be associated with the person in any way other than the fact that that's the person who took the test.
Cottage industry.
Enterprising entrepreneurship.
Yeah. Any questions for Mr. Smith? So the guy who's going to get the license should take the test, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No one else has signed up, and that doesn't mean anything today. Does anybody else want to comment on this bill? Oh, yes. Mr. Kafoury, come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, of the committee. Stephen Kafoury, representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. And we agree that the person who takes the test should have control over the business. And you know, we take a test, we go through it, and we have to compete against people who don't. We think that's wrong. So we support the bill.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Close public hearing, House Bill 2111. Open work session on House Bill 2111.
Mr. Chairman, the bill is the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2111 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Deckert, since you were carrying the previous bill that we assigned you when you were out of the room, these are related, so I will ask that you also carry House Bill 2111.
Everyone's
by the way, would you like to vote on the bill you're carrying?
No, let's make it so I didn't vote on it, but
okay.
I'm carrying it.
All right. Then let's go to a work session on Senate Bill 85. Janet. And thank you for carrying those bills, Senator, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 85, you heard at the end of January, and this was the bill that had to do with pole attachments and to at the request of the Public Utility Commission, and would have subjected public bodies to utility pole attachment regulation for poles and facilities that are in public rights of way. There's been a work group that has worked very hard on amendments to this bill, and those are the -2 amendments, and Rick Willis is here from the Public Utility Commission to explain the -2 amendments, and some of the local government and utility people are here as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, Mr. Willis, why don't you come forward, if there's anybody you want to bring with you, and then we do have some representatives in the audience, and you may come forward after we've heard those comments, or you may not, or whatever. Oh, yes. Yeah, this is a great handout. Is everybody, have you seen this?
No, sir, I haven't.
Yeah, well, this is the ultimate pole attachment. We'll just pass it around here.
Right.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzgers, member of the committee. My name is Rick Willis, Executive Director of the Public Utility Commission. With me is J.R. Gonzalez, and Mr. Gonzalez is head of our safety section, which handles pole attachments issues. Since our meeting, we had one in January where we brought up this bill. And let me explain a little bit about what the bill does and what the amendments that we have before you do. SB 85 expands the definition of licensee to include public bodies that construct pole attachments for distributing electrical or communication services to the public. This expanded definition is necessary to correct an inequity in the pole attachments requirements or regulations, and that is currently public bodies are exempted from those regulations. So since the last hearing on this, we've held three meetings and had numerous revisions and emails and phone calls with interested parties to clarify the language and gain consensus. The result is the Dash 2 amendments that are before you. And while I don't think there's anybody who can say they got everything they wanted, I believe that the amendments meet the needs of the interested parties as well as our original intent for the bill, which was to create a level playing field for pole attachments. Let me point out just a couple out of the key provisions of the SB 85. The bill exempts public bodies who construct systems for their own use, for the use of another public body, or for public safety purposes for which there's no charge. People's utility districts, PUDs, are exempt from the sanction rules, and that is PUDs can neither sanction nor be sanctioned. And the law becomes operative on September 1st of next year, 2008. And that's to give folks who are new to these regulations time to implement the requirements. One final note I'd like to make is that we are currently in the process of a rule making on pole attachments, and that's including wireless issues, and that this bill would have no impact on those discussions and would not impact the treatment of wireless facilities. And with that, Mr. Chair, the Commission would urge your support.
Okay. Well, thank you, and I appreciate your work on that, because I know the committee had some questions with some of the interested parties about that definition and the sanctioning issue. Senator Mona Sanderson has a question.
Explain to me when, say, a school district allows a company to have a pole put on their property. How does this bill affect that? Because you're saying that it requires public bodies to enter contracts prior to making attachments to utility poles if it's owned by others. And in this case, it is owned by others. Is there going to be a problem with poles that are located on public property but owned, they're actually leasing the property?
Mr. Chair, I'll ask Mr. Gonzalez. He's the one who deals with those daily. So.
Yeah, Chairman Metzger, Senator Anderson.
Please state your name first.
I'm sorry. My name is J.R. Gonzalez. I'm the Program Manager for Safety Reliability Section of the PUC.
Thank you.
The question you asked, you cited the example of a school district allowing a private party to put a pole in their property. That pole, the attachment goes on poles for services that are provided. Usually the owner of the pole in question for pole attachment would be utilities. Operators of communication and power services could be fiber communication as well, or wireless for that matter. So in those poles is what the statutes that we have for pole attachments address. If a independent party wants to attach a single pole into a school district yard for the purpose of establishing an antenna, would be outside of this statute.
Outside of the statute.
Correct. It's not owned by an operator. So there is no need for a contract per se by a utility provider, service provider, for that pole to be on that school property.
If this pole is, say, a wireless and could be used for other things and they go to the contractor who owns it, will they be able to put on more? I'm not sure if I'm explaining. Without going through the school district, would they be able to put other services on that pole?
Chairman Metzger, Senator Anderson, yes, the answer to that question is yes. The full owner in question would not be
like
part
that.
Of the requirement of the statute because they are not a utility operator providing services in this particular field, communication and power. In the case of a wireless provider, there are many towers and poles that are installed throughout the country, including Oregon, that is for their specific network. They oftentimes allow other operators to attach to their pole, i.e. antennas, for wireless services, and they do have contracts and they have provisions, but that's to them. These statutes do not cover that.
Questions? Other questions? Oh, Janet.
I have a question. One of the issues at the hearing from the public entities was the ability of a private company to sanction if the private company owns a pole and the ability of the private company to sanction a public body. So how do the amendments deal with that situation?
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, this allows for those sanctions if the public body is providing services to the public that is in competition with the private entities. We have these provisions, these exemptions in there when it's the public body providing a service to itself, to another public body, or for safety purposes for no charge. Other than that, then they fall under these regulations, which means they can both sanction and be sanctioned, except for the PUDs that I mentioned earlier.
So directly or through the PUC?
Mr. Chair, they can sanction each other through the contract. PUC has certain powers, and that is for the safety, and all of these fall under safety regulations, which JR and his group handle, and those are penalties. But the sanctioning is between the pole owner and the attachee.
Okay, other questions? I see we have some the municipal utilities in the room. Team Dewey's here. Cities are here. Counties. Do we have anybody else wishes to testify on this bill? Do we have nods? Do we have concerns? If so, you may come forward. I don't have them on my list to sign up. Okay.
One right. Nod that has
all right.
Concerned.
No, well, you want to make sure we got everything covered here. Okay. So I appreciate your work on that and bringing the amendment for us. Dash 2. Yes, Senator Starr.
Dash 2 amendment, Senate Bill 785.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment, Senate Bill 85. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 85 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Anybody like to carry this bill?
Oh. I was going to...
you carry the bill.
No. I don't really want to carry the bill.
George Volunteer.
Actually, Senator Montes Anderson, why don't you carry the bill, please? Senator George.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to serve a notice of potential minority report on House Bill 2079.
Okay. Senator George has served notice of a possible, this would be a first on the Board of Accountancy, minority report on House Bill 2079. Nothing before us, we're adjourned.